Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1369, Career on Our Minds, part 2. This is being recorded on January 25th of the year 2025. We are going to be doing a long series about Korea, what has been going on, what has been going on. There was an attempt by President Yoon of South Korea to declare martial law in early December of last year, and that may very well have been connected not only to a plot to restart the Korean War, but apparently, according to some sources, killing American military personnel with the assassins or the assailants being dressed in North Korean uniforms, basically a false flag operation with Donald Trump in office. I think that the possibilities of igniting a third world war with shenanigans like that are very, very real. I certainly would not count on Donald Trump to be a measure of temperance with regard to something like that, anything but. We heard in our last program a long excerpt from For the Record Program 1142, The Deep Politics and the Death of Park Won-soon, Part 2. And again, the late Park Won-soon was not only viewed as a strong presidential candidate in the elections of 2022, but he had a very progressive attitude toward women. He was very critical of Japan and Japan's colonial occupation of Korea, and very active on behalf of the attempts by the surviving comfort women, the slave prostitutes who were employed by Japan to get proper compensation, and had been working to improve relations between North and South Korea. He allegedly died of a suicide following an alleged hashtag Me Too infraction. I'm very skeptical about both. But in any event, the alleged suicide of Park Won-soon removed him as a presidential candidate, and the new People's Power Party right-wing President Yoon, again, attempted to declare martial law in early December of last year and may very well have been moving to reignite the Korean War, a very dangerous, explosive situation. One cannot understand South Korea without understanding the history of Imperial Japan, Japanese fascism, Japan's colonial occupation of Korea beginning in the early 20th century, I should say. And we're going to take a look at that right now. There is a very good blog, and by the way, this blog post will be reproduced in the written description for the record 1369, and there are some very important links as well. The blog is exposingimperialjapan.com, and this is the post from December 10th of 2024. It is called How the War Criminals of Imperial Japan Shaped Modern South Korean Politics and Business. The pro-Japanese legacy that Kishi, Sasakawa, and Kadama left behind in Korean conservatism. That refers to Nobusuke Kishi. It's in Western spelling pronunciation. It's Kishi Nobusuke, N-O-B-U-S-U-K-E, Reiki Sasakawa and Yoshio Kadama. But in Asian culture, the last name would be put, we would consider it to be the last name would be put first. So it would be Nobusuke Kishi, Reiki Sasakawa, and Kadama Yoshio, names very well known to veteran listeners, particularly Sasakawa and Kadama. Nobusuke Kishi signed the declaration of war for Japan against the U.S. His grandson, Abe Shinzo, was the right-wing prime minister of Japan and was assassinated, allegedly because of his support for the Unification Church of Sun Myung Moon. We are going to read about Kishi and his career from another of the remarkable books by the Seagraves, this the Amato Dynasty, the book before Gold Warriors. However, again, one cannot understand South Korea without understanding the legacy there of Imperial Japan / Fascist Japan. And again, this blog post from ExposingImperialJapan.com with some very important links from December 10th of 2024 does just that. Again, the title of the blog post, How the War Criminals of Imperial Japan Shaped Modern South Korean Politics and Business. The pro-Japanese legacy that Kishi, Sasakawa, and Kodama left behind in Korean conservatism. And we're going to take a look at the, and I'm not sure about the pronunciation, the Chaebol, the C-H-A-E-B-O-L-S of South Korea. Those are the giant family trusts, basically patterned after and in many cases evolved from, more or less, the zaibatsu that dominate the Japanese economic landscape, the giant family trusts like Mitsubishi, Mitsui, Sumitomo, and Yasuda. And as we will see, the Chaebols, C-H-A-E-B-O-L-S, not only dominate the South Korean landscape, but they are inextricably linked with the history of imperial/fascist Japan's occupation of Korea. Now, this post reads, As a Japanese blogger posting content about Imperial Japan's colonization of Korea, I have been following the latest news coming out of South Korea and noticed the dismay that many Korean citizens have about the, quote, pro-Japanese, unquote, nature of their conservative politicians. By pro-Japanese, they refer to the way Korean conservative politicians are deferential toward Japanese politicians in matters of historical disputes, economic collaboration, and security agreements. This deferential stance is often seen in the handling of contentious historical issues such as the acknowledgement of wartime and colonial atrocities and abuses, reparations for victims of forced labor and sexual slavery, and the preservation of Japan's national narrative over these events. By the way, one of the things that had led to the lack of popularity of President Yoon was his settling of some of the grievances of Korean slave laborers who worked for some of the giant Japanese corporations. More about that labor. Again, we haven't heard much about Yoon, but again, he proposed, I think, like a 120-hour work week with no pay for overtime. Doctors were on strike. Maybe they're still on strike in South Korea over the working conditions that they have had the labor under. But one of the things that has been most unpopular about President Yoon has been his handling of attempts at settling the grievances of the Korean slave laborers who toiled for the zaibatsu in fascist/imperial Japan. This last paragraph one more time. By the way, I recently had oral surgery, so if my mouth parts don't sound quite right, well, there's a reason for that. Because it sounds like an insect, my mouth parts. But speaking of the pro-Japanese orientation of Korean conservative politicians, once again, this deferential stance is often seen in the handling of contentious historical issues such as the acknowledgement of wartime and colonial atrocities and abuses, reparations for victims of forced labor and sexual slavery, and the preservation of Japan's national narrative over these events. Furthermore, it is reflected in agreements or compromises that seem to prioritize Japan's strategic and diplomatic interests over addressing long-standing grievances held by South Korean citizens. These actions have often left a significant portion of the Korean populace feeling that their leaders are neglecting national dignity and justice in favor of maintaining close ties with Japan. In this post, I'm going to tell a narrative to partly answer the question as to why those pro-Japanese tendencies persist in the Korean conservative movement in Korea, including some links with sources for further reading. And again, those links will be reproduced in the written description for this program. Continuing. This is by no means a comprehensive answer, but I hope this post becomes a resource to gather much of the relevant historical information about this issue in one place. In this narrative, I trace how Nobusuke Kishi organized former war criminals and other prominent former Imperial Japanese government and military officials to reconstitute as much of the former Imperial Japanese regime as possible in the post-war environment, then exert influence in Korea. Others have posted more detailed information online which explain how Kishi and his successors came to dominate the Liberal Democratic Party and Japanese politics, but in this post, I will focus more on the interactions that Kishi's associates had with Korean government officials and businessmen over the decades to exert power and influence over South Korea in the post-war era. Through this exploration, I hope to provide readers with a deeper understanding of why these pro-Japanese tendencies persist in Korea and what it reveals about the ongoing impact of Imperial Japan's colonial legacy in Korea. We will begin this narrative in 1940s, defeated post-war Japan, ravaged by World War II, and occupied by Allied forces. The Americans have imprisoned the Class A war criminals at Sugamo Prison. However, other war criminals were released once the Americans decided that they could become useful anti-communist leaders of post-war Japan. Among the released war criminals was Kishi Nobusuke, a key architect of Imperial Japan's wartime economy. That last sentence one more time. Among the released war criminals was Nobusuke Kishi, a key architect of Imperial Japan's wartime economy. Kishi emerged from Sugamo Prison in the post-war years with a renewed ambition to reconstitute as much of the old Imperial Japan as possible. He was emboldened by his observation that the Americans did not care what his true political beliefs were as long as he was a staunch anti-communist. Imprisoned as a suspected Class A war criminal, Kishi befriended two fellow war criminals who would become instrumental to his vision, Sasakawa Ryuichi and Kadama Yoshio. Together, these men cultivated a network that blended political influence, corporate ambition, and organized crime to reshape Japan's role in East Asia. And although he doesn't mention that the phenomenal wealth of the Golden Lily program, as set forth in Gold Warriors, is a fundamental part of this. Continuing. In wartime Japan, Sasakawa was the founder and leader of the National Essence League, one of the most extreme right-wing political organizations in Imperial Japan. Sasakawa admired Benito Mussolini and modeled his organization on Italian fascist principles, even visiting Nazi Germany and fascist Italy in 1939. While he held the position as a Diet, that's D-I-E, capital D-I-E-T, that's a Japanese parliament, spelled like the American word Diet, but pronounced Diet. While he held the position as a Diet parliament member, Sasakawa spent much of the war giving motivational speeches to the Imperial Army and the general public across the empire to boost war morale. In his remarks during one visit to Korea in 1943, he encouraged leaders to, quote, punch Koreans with an iron fist, unquote, if they seemed unsteady and unfocused, claiming that such actions were acts of love necessary to bring them back in line. This philosophy aligned with the broader Imperial Japanese military culture, which heavily relied on corporal punishment. In this way, he normalized the physical abuse of Koreans and rationalized it as an act of tough love to mold the Koreans into, quote, true Japanese people, unquote. While incarcerated at Sugamo Prison, Sasakawa kept a detailed diary that highlighted his belief in aligning Japan with a pro-American, anti-communist stance. During his time at Sugamo Prison, he worked tirelessly to improve the treatment of prisoners, earning respect from both high-ranking war criminals, and lower-tier detainees. Sasakawa famously referred to Sugamo Prison as his, quote, ultimate university, unquote, a place where he built relationships that later connected him to Japan's post-war establishment. Sasakawa later supported the controversial Unification Church founder Sun Myung-moon in his anti-communist activities. From 1968 to 1972, Sasakawa was the honorary president and patron of the Japanese branch of the International Federation for Victory Over Communism, or Kokusai Shokyo Rengo, which forged intimate ties with Japan's conservative politicians. Alan Pate Wood, capital W-O-O-D, a former top American political leader of the Unification Church of the U.S., recalled his surprise upon hearing Sasakawa telling an audience, referring to himself, quote, "I am Mr. Moon's dog," unquote. Kadama, who was designated as the, quote, fixer, unquote, by Kishi, utilized his connections to play a pivotal role in normalizing Japan-South Korean relations in 1965. Following the Normalization Treaty of 1965, Kadama frequently visited South Korea, where he liaised with members of Park Chung-hee's administration, serving as a fixer for Japanese corporations and the Yakuza. By the way, Park Chung-hee began his start in the Imperial Japanese Army during World War II. Actually, prior to World War II. Continuing. Kadama's influence facilitated the inflow of 500... Actually, no, I guess Park Chung-hee actually began his combat career in the Sino-Japanese War that led directly into... It became part of World War II. It began, actually, in 1937. That last sentence again. Following the, by the way, Park Chung-hee, the dictator of South Korea, and again someone who got his start in the Imperial Japanese military, Park Chung-hee and his daughter will figure prominently in these programs. Repeating the last sentence. Following the Normalization Treaty of 1965, Kadama frequently visited South Korea, where he liaised with members of Park Chung-hee's administration, serving as a fixer for Japanese corporations and the Yakuza. Kadama's influence facilitated the inflow of $500 million in reparations and economic aid from Japan, which jump-started South Korea's industrial development and created lucrative opportunities for Japanese businesses. One of Kishi's most significant collaborations was with Ryuzo Sejima. Actually, that would be Sejima, capital S-E-J-I-M-A, and Ryuzo, capital R-Y-U-Z-O, a formal Imperial Army officer turned corporate strategist. Sejima, who served 11 years as a Soviet prisoner of war, joined Kishi in forging the Japan-South Korea Cooperation Committee, which solidified ties between the two nations. This committee laid the groundwork for deep economic and political collaboration, with figures like Sejima serving as trusted intermediaries. The normalization of relations between Japan and South Korea in 1965, made possible by a partnership between Kishi and South Korean dictator Park Chung-hee, was not merely a diplomatic milestone. It was a strategic alignment against the shared threat of communism. The reparations package and subsequent economic cooperation enabled Japanese firms to enter the Korean market, further intertwining the two countries' fates. Park Chung-hee, a former officer in the Japanese-controlled Manchukuo Army, shared ideological and personal ties with Kishi and his associates. Park preferred to surround himself with fellow Imperial Army Academy graduates, such as Paik Sun-yup, that's capital P-A-I-K, capital S-U-N hyphen Y-U-P, a decorated hero of the Korean War, but a controversial figure due to his earlier service in the Gando Special Force of the Imperial Japanese Army in Manchuria from 1943 to 1945. By the way, we dealt with the obituary of Paik Sun-yup in the aforementioned For the Record program 1142 and 1143. Continuing. Paik was also involved in putting down the Yosef Suncheon Rebellion of October of 1948, a brutal operation marked by ransacking, raping, and killing of civilians, with many of the soldiers still wearing old Japanese army uniforms. This choice of associates reflected Park's reliance on figures who, like himself, shared a connection to Japan's colonial and military institutions. The predominance of pro-Japanese sentiments within South Korea's conservative elite can be traced back to the early days of Syngman Rhee's presidency. Rhee, capital R-H-E-E, whose domestic support base was weak, was forced to rely on collaborators with Imperial Japan to staff key positions in the police and military. The South Korean Army, for instance, was largely founded and commanded by former officers of the Japanese military, while the police force was similarly dominated by those who had served under the colonial administration. This extended to other sectors as well, including the judiciary, the media, education, culture, and religion. While Rhee himself cannot be described as pro-Japanese, the pillars of his government overlapped significantly with individuals who had thrived during Japan's colonial rule. This last sentence, a couple sentences again, because it's fundamental. And we're going to come back to the Korean War and how it actually started later on in this series. In fact, we're going to touch on General Kim Suk-won later on in this program, perhaps in the next program. Speaking of Syngman Rhee, Rhee, whose domestic support base was weak, was forced to rely on collaborators with Imperial Japan to staff key positions in the police and military. The South Korean Army, for instance, was largely founded and commanded by former officers of the Japanese military, while the police force was similarly dominated by those who had served under the colonial administration. This extended to other sectors as well, including the judiciary, media, education, culture, and religion. While Rhee himself cannot be described as pro-Japanese, the pillars of his government overlapped significantly with individuals who had thrived during Japan's colonial rule. Again, military, police, judiciary, media, education, culture, and religion. That's a pretty clean sweep. Continuing. The Special Committee for Prosecution of Anti-National Activities, established in October of 1948 to address collaboration during the colonial period, was quickly dismantled after just over a year of activity. Although the committee compiled a list of approximately 7,000 alleged collaborators and arrested some prominent figures, its efforts were suppressed by the very police force that included former colonial officials. The committee's officers were raided, effectively curbing its operations. The narrative of South Korea's conservative elite shifted after independence. Their justification for maintaining power and influence centered on staunch anti-communism, pro-Americanism, and conservatism. Many former collaborators once allied with Japan rapidly recast themselves as pro-American defenders of South Korea's nascent democracy. In the context of a fierce Cold War rivalry with North Korea, this repositioning allowed them to frame their actions as vital for the survival of the state rather than remnants of colonial oppression. During the post-war period, Kishi and his allies cultivated relationships with South Korea's emerging conservative elite, including Reverend Sun Myung-moon and business magnates such as Samsung's Lee Byung-chul and POSCO's Park Tae-jun. By the way, Samsung, one of the giants of contemporary electronics, and a major focal point of former President Joe Biden's chip program, and a major player in the push against China, as are South Korea and Japan. More about that later. This last sentence again. During the post-war period, Kishi and his allies cultivated relationships with South Korea's emerging conservative elite, including Reverend Sun Myung-moon and business magnates such as Samsung's Lee Byung-chul and POSCO's Park Tae-joon. Lee Byung-chul's business empire had its origins during the colonial era in Korea with the establishment of Samsung's Sangho, capital S-A-N-G-H-O-E, in Daegu, or Daegu, B-A-E-G-U, on March 1st, 1938, initially focused on exporting dried fish and apples. His business success during this period likely would not have been possible without at least some collaboration with Imperial Japanese authorities. Samsung continues to exert significant political influence in conservative circles to this day. For example, the People's Power Party recruited Ko Dong-jin, that's capital K-O-H, last name capital D-O-N-G, hyphen small J-I-N, an advisor to Samsung Electronics ahead of the April 10th general elections in 2024. Tsujima played an instrumental role in shaping South Korea's export-driven economy by advising on the establishment of trading companies and industrial giants. His insights were so valued that employees at Samsung Group organized book clubs around the Japanese novel it's called The Wasteland in English, spelled in Japanese, capital F-U-M-O-U, last example C-H-I-T-A-I, whose protagonist was modeled after Tsujima. Another key contact for Kishi's associates was Kim Jong-pil, head of the Korean Central Intelligence Agency, or KCIA, and a close associate of Park Chung-hee. Kim's support for the Unification Church, led by Reverend Moon, exemplified his efforts to consolidate a conservative, anti-communist bloc within South Korea. Notably, Kim, along with Park Chung-hee and Park Tae-joon, spoke Japanese so fluently that the Japanese diplomat once remarked that they seemed, quote, indistinguishable from native Japanese speakers, unquote. Additionally, Kim's brother held secret discussions in Japan with Ichiro Kono, or Kono Ichiro, K-O-N-O, and then kind of I-C-H-I-R-O, leading to an agreement to leave the contentious Takashimo Dokdo issue unresolved, encapsulated by the phrase, quote, settlement by not settling, unquote. Again, there are links in there to flesh out people's understanding, and this blog post will be reproduced in the descriptions for the record 1369. So if some of this is mysterious to listeners, you can just check out the written description on the SpitfireList.com website. Continuing. Tsujima's deep connection with South Korea is evident in his memoir, Many Mountains and Rivers, or Ikuzunga, I-K-U-Z-A-N-J-A, published in 1995. Tsujima praised former President Park Chung-hee as a, quote, self-disciplined leader with profound insight and leadership, unquote, and expressed special respect for Lee Byung-chul, the founder of Samsung, calling him a, quote, revered senior brother and teacher, unquote. Through Lee Byung-chul, Tsujima also forged ties with former presidents Chun Doo-hwan and Roh Tae-woo. Chun Doo-hwan and Roh Tae-woo, both military generals turned presidents who succeeded Park Chung-hee after his assassination in 1979, admired Tsujima as a senior officer and respected his strategic insights. Chun Doo-hwan, in particular, felt that defending the Korean Peninsula from the North Korean threat was not solely South Korea's burden, but a shared responsibility with Japan. Chun argued that Japan, given its proximity and vested interests in regional stability, should actively contribute to South Korea's defense capabilities. This stance led Chun to push for economic and military support from Japan, framing it as essential for the collective security of East Asia. These appeals resonated with Japanese leaders who viewed a stable and anti-communist South Korea as a crucial buffer against northern aggression. A key episode highlighting Tsujima's close connections with South Korean leadership was his meeting with Kwon Ilk-hyun, K-O, KWOM, as in capital I-K hyphen H-Y-U-N, a prominent member of the Democratic Justice Party with strong ties to the Samsung Corporation. In December of 1982, acting as a special envoy for Prime Minister Nakasone Yasuhiro, Sugima met Kwon Ik-hyun at Gimhae Airport for a secret meeting. That's capital G-I-M-H-A-E. The two reached a fundamental agreement to resolve the strained Japan-South Korea relations caused by issues such as Japan's history textbook controversies and economic cooperation loans. This agreement paved the way for Nakasone Yasuhiro's official visit to South Korea, aimed at resetting bilateral ties. Kwon, known for his strategic thinking and influence within South Korea's conservative elite, worked closely with business magnates like Lee Byung-chul to align political and corporate interests. Through Kwon, Sugima was able to deepen his understanding of South Korea's economic and political dynamics, further solidifying the partnership between Japanese and Korean elites. Nakasone Yasuhiro's historic visit to Seoul in 1983 marked a new phase of Japan-South Korea cooperation. Behind the scenes, Sugima's quiet diplomacy helped negotiate key economic loans that funded South Korea's infrastructure, including the Seoul subway and power plants, while advancing Japan's regional interests. This allowed Japan to influence South Korea's political and economic trajectory in the 1980s, culminating in events like the 1988 Seoul Olympics, which bolstered South Korea's global standing. The historical legacy of this network resurfaced in later years when Park Chung-hee's daughter, Park Jun-hee, P-A-R-K, last name capital C-H-U-N-G hyphen H-E-E, his daughter, capital P-A-R-K, last name capital G-E-U-N hyphen H-Y-E, one more time. The historical legacy of this network resurfaced in later years when Park Chung-hee's daughter, Park Jun-hai, served as president of South Korea. In the poignant moment of historical significance, she met with Abe Shinzo, the grandson of Nobusuke Kishi, in 2015 during her presidency. This meeting resulted in an agreement intended to, quote, finally and irreversibly, unquote, settle the contentious issue of comfort women. As part of the agreement, the Japanese government pledged $9 million to a fund for the surviving victims. For Japanese conservatives, this relatively small sum was seen as a way to put the darker aspects of Imperial Japan's past to rest permanently, effectively allowing them to bury the history of wartime atrocities and abuses without further scrutiny. They viewed this as a significant political victory, expressing gratitude to South Korea's conservative leadership for facilitating such a resolution. One more time. They, meaning Japanese conservatives, they viewed this as a significant political victory, expressing gratitude to South Korea's conservative leadership for facilitating such a resolution. Indeed, Korean conservatives honored this agreement by refraining from criticizing Japan on the comfort women issue at a recent UN conference discussing women's human rights issues. And again, the late Park Won-soon was very critical of the treatment of the comfort women and the very modest $9 million settlement for same. Continuing. This 2015 meeting between Park and Abe also symbolized the enduring influence of their respective family legacies in shaping Japan-South Korea relations. The interaction highlighted how the ideological and political frameworks established by Kishi and Park Chung-hee have continued to influence the bilateral dynamics between the two nations. So what now? How is this relevant to the present? Many of the politicians and businessmen mentioned in this post have descendants and proteges who continue to carry on their legacy and dominate Korean conservative politics today. For instance, Paik Sun-yup's daughter, Paik Nam-hee, P-A-I-K, last name capital N-A-M hyphen A-G-E, recently established the Paik Sun-yup Memorial Foundation, describing it as, quote, an organization of hope that consoles the hearts of the victims of the Korean War and their bereaved families, unquote. This foundation portrays her father's career in the most favorable light while omitting references to his controversial actions. Similarly, Samsung remains a family-run enterprise, with the founder Lee Byung-chul's grandson now serving as its chairman, perpetuating the legacy of its founder. The People's Power Party of Korea today has strong incentives to safeguard the reputations of a president. One more time. The People's Power Party of Korea today has strong incentives to safeguard the reputations of their predecessors, actively avoiding any revelations that might tarnish their image. This includes downplaying or suppressing colonial history, such as, such scrutiny could expose uncomfortable truths about Korean collaborators during the Imperial Japanese colonial period. As long as the collaborators and their descendants retain influence, a comprehensive and honest examination of Korea's colonial and Cold War history may remain out of reach. Ultimately, the neo-imperialist ambitions of Nobusuke Kishi and his allies were not a direct attempt to restore Imperial Japan, but rather to secure Japan's position as a regional leader in the Cold War context. Through alliances with figures like Park Chung-hee, Chun Doo-hwan, and South Korea's business elite, they leveraged historical ties and strategic interests to reshape East Asia. Today, their legacy remains deeply embedded in the political and economic structures of Japan-South Korea relations, for better or worse. What we're going to do now is to turn to another of the Seagrave's remarkable books, this, The Amato Dynasty, published in hardcover by Broadway Books of New York, and again, copyright 1999, by Sperling and Peggy Seagrave. And of Nobusuke Kishi, they write in The Amato Dynasty, Kishi personally bridged the pre-war and post-war epics, going from deal-making for the Kwantung Army in Manchuria to deal-making for Japan Incorporated without breaking stride. His story is an object lesson in the cross-dressing of high finance. Physically, he resembled a salamander. Born Nobusuke Seito in 1896 in Choshu, now called Yamaguchi Prefecture, he was so quick-witted and clever that he was adopted by a paternal uncle bearing the Kishi name. His brothers stayed at home and used the Seito name. One brother, Isaku Seito, became a post-war finance minister and LDP prime minister. Eldest brother, Ichiro Seito, became an admiral. After Tokyo University, Nobusuke Kishi got a job in the Ministry of Commerce and Industry filing policy papers and correspondence, which gave him insider information. During the Great Depression, his star rose quickly when he showed rich investors how easy it was to gobble up and loot small firms that were going under. He became a wizard in the creation of cartels and trusts. Japan's seizure of Manchuria in 1931 gave him his big chance. He was sent there to investigate industrial possibilities. He made friends with General Tojo, chief of the secret police in Manchuria, and showed Tojo how the army could squeeze private shareholders out of the state-controlled South Manchurian Railroad Company, or SMRC. The SMRC had all the rights to exploit Manchu railways, harbors, ports, mines, oil, hotels, transport and communication, and was already one of the largest capital resource units in the world. Fortuitously, the president of the SMRC was Kishi's uncle. By now, just last sentence again. Fortuitously, the president of the SMRC was Kishi's uncle by marriage. Kishi showed his uncle how the SMRC could greatly increase its profits if the Kwantung Army and the Japanese underworld used state power to bring Manchuria into submission. In other words, Kishi promoted the use of terror and extortion to advance the Japanese army's wealth in Manchuria. He was able to arrange for army-controlled Manchuria to enjoy the most modern administrative skills by bringing in one of Japan's most successful new Zaibatsu, Nissan, which was headed by another of Kishi's uncles. By putting his two uncles together with General Pojo, Kishi rolled together the interests of politics, army, business, and gangsters in a way that would have deeply impressed Hitler and Stalin. Manchuria under Kishi also became the prime source of heroin in Asia. He made the Kwantung Army so rich that it could act independently of Tokyo and could go off to start the China War on its own. Thanks in large measure to Kishi, General Pojo was such a success that he became the Kwantung Army's chief of staff and eventually Japan's wartime dictator. So we have Kishi to thank for many things. During the war, Kishi was promoted to Minister of Commerce and Industry in Tokyo and also served Pojo as Vice Minister of Munitions. After Japan's surrender, Kishi was jailed in Sagamo Prison on charges of looting China and Manchuria, theft of private assets, and enslaving thousands to work in Japanese factories and mines. On the eve of his arrest, Kishi received a telegram from a crony, quote, "Americans aren't likely to convict and execute you, so advise don't do anything rash," i.e. don't admit to anything. In Sagamo Prison, Kishi mingled with a who's who of politicians, businessmen, bureaucrats, and outlaws. Among his cellmates were underworld godfather Kodama and the extremist future founder of the LDP, Hatoyama, who favored beheading all political opponents. So Sagamo Prison was a finishing school for scoundrels. During the war, Kodama, the most famous of Japan's tattooed outlaws, the Yakuza, had made billions sidetracking war loot, and in 1945 was the richest man in Japan after the emperor. Kodama had already paid for the founding of the Liberal Party, and now he offered to found another party for Hatoyama if Hatoyama agreed to let Kishi handle all the finances. Hatoyama would be leader of the new Democratic Party, but Kishi would be the money man and backroom deal maker. They agreed, and Kodama turned over millions of dollars to set up a slush fund. This was only a drop in the bucket. ESCAP, that's Allied Occupation of Japan. ESCAP estimated Kodama's worth in 1945 to be $13.5 billion, probably only a small portion of the actual. Again, it's $13.5 billion in 1945. That's a lot of money. One more time. ESCAP estimated Kodama's worth in 1945 to be $13.5 billion, probably only a small portion of the actual total. That's $13.5 billion. Continuing. Kodama only admitted publicly to having $200 million and generously offered to give all of that to ESCAP to split between America's friend, Generalissimo Chiang Kai-shek, and the Counterintelligence Corps, or CIC, a forerunner of the CIA. When Washington secretly accepted Kodama's offer, Kodama and Kishi were quietly released from Sagamo and were never prosecuted for their leading roles in the dark side of the war. The American CIC was so appreciative of this $200 million bribe that Kodama was later hired as an expert on red-bashing during the Korean War. He remained on the CIA payroll until the Lockheed scandal in the 1970s. Kodama was useful for much more than red-bashing and black gold. During the war, Kodama had specialized in moving not only gold and diamonds, but also strategic materials such as tungsten used for hardening metals in aircraft and missile applications. Tons of this strategic material had been looted from China and stockpiled in underground vaults at Japanese military installations. On one occasion after the war, Joseph Gu, he was a Morgan protege and the ambassador of Japan. On one occasion after the war, Gu's right-hand man at the ACJ, Eugene Dumont, D-O-O-N-A-N, carried out a covert operation with Kodama to smuggle tons of this Luffy potion from Japan to America. Kodama was paid $2.8 million for his role in this secret operation. After his release from Sagamo Prison, Kishi, backed by Kodama's Black Mummy and using Hatoyama's well-oiled political network, established himself as one of Japan's first great post-war kingmakers. Meanwhile, his brother Asako Seifu had risen to be chief secretary to Prime Minister Yoshida. When the new Liberal Democratic Party came into existence, it was able to buy a substantial majority in the Diet, thus preventing timely rivals from ever coming to power. Having bought control of parliament, the LDP could claim that it was Japan's supreme moral authority next to the emperor. So long as he remained in the background, Kishi's power was unchallenged. But when he let his friends or his enemies encourage him to become prime minister, 1957-60, he got into trouble immediately. His call for the rearmament of Japan provoked violent protests in Tokyo. Embarrassed, he resigned. Behind the scenes once more, he remained a leading fixer for years thereafter, but in gradual decline. And that again about Nobusuke Kishi. And some more about Manchuria under Japanese rule. Manchukuo was what it was called when it became a Japanese colony. And this from a review of the book Gold Warriors in Cover Punch magazine of September 25th of 2003 by the brilliant Douglas Valentine, and talking about the Manchukuo drug traffic. They, the Japanese, built roads and create industries, and more importantly, they work with corrupt warlords and Chinese gangsters associated with Chiang Kai-shek's Kuomintang Party to transform Manchuria into a vast poppy field. By 1937, the Japanese and their gangster and Kuomintang associates are responsible for 90% of the world's illicit narcotics. They turn Manchu Emperor Pu Yi into an addict and open thousands of opium dens as a way of suppressing the Chinese one more time. By 1937, the Japanese and their gangster and Kuomintang associates are responsible for 90% of the world's illicit narcotics. They turn Manchu Emperor Pu Yi into an addict and open thousands of opium dens as a way of suppressing the Chinese. And next we're going to talk more about Manchuria and the influence of the Manchurians, as the author here characterizes them. This from the Asia Pacific Journal of February 7th of the year 2008. This call is by Suk Jung Han. That's capital S-U-K hyphen capital J-U-N-G, less than capital H-A-N. On the question of collaboration in South Korea, again by Suk Jung Han, Asia Pacific Journal, February 7th of 2008, skipping down. It would be meaningful to objectively analyze the roles, logic, and impact of pro-Japanese collaborators in post-colonial South Korea, a nation that has been and continues to be haunted by the issue of collaboration. I want to point out that many who have been labeled collaborators possessed a certain human capital that proved useful to the rulers of this new state formation. In considering their role and their achievements in South Korea, however, we wish to call attention to something big, the so-called structural factor. That is the question of U.S. hegemony in the Cold War era. In the next section, Manchurians as the ultimate victors. The most dramatic case of the rise of a former collaborator in South Korea is that of General and ex-President Park Chung-hee, who was widely credited with leading its sparkling economic surge in the 1960s. He attended military academy in both Manchukuo and Japan and became a low-ranking officer in the Manchukuo Army. After liberation, he joined the newly founded Korean Army, and his 1961 coup d'etat inaugurated a nearly two-decade-long reign. Park thus reenacted in South Korea two historical events witnessed earlier in Manchukuo: military revolt followed by state-led industrialization. Park was not alone. His rise in South Korea went hand-in-hand with the rise of others who served in Manchuria, now northeast China, where Japan's Kwantung Army founded the puppet state of Manchukuo from 1932 to 1945. Until the 1960s, numerous South Korean politicians claimed to have fought the Japanese in Manchuria. Manchuria was a mythic land in which people freely drew their own self-portrait. Even those who had never been there did so. For instance, the Nobel laureate ex-president Kim Dae-jung falsely claimed during his 1971 presidential election that he had attended Zhangho University in Manchuria. I spoke of J-I-A-N-G-U-O. Regardless of their past, a number of Koreans who had been in Manchuria during the colonial period after returning home transformed themselves into anti-Japanese fighters. Actually, there had been an exodus of some 700,000 Koreans to Manchuria on the initiative of the colonial government in the 1930s. The number of Koreans in Manchuria exceeded 2 million by 1945. Manchuria became their El Dorado while grappling with the harsh conditions on a new frontier. Many rose to prominence in post-liberation Korea. In particular, those who had studied at flagship military academies and colleges in Manchukuo would lead South Korea's industrialization and urbanization bars of the 1960s. One more time. In particular, those who had studied at flagship military academies and colleges in Manchukuo would lead South Korea's industrialization and urbanization drives in the 1960s. In numerous Western colonies, native agents of the state who mastered the master language were among the first to be exposed to the winds of colonial modernity. They were schooled in such ingredients of modernity as punctuality, monthly salary, bureaucratic spill, as well as... bureaucratic skill, as well as military skills of drill, firearms, and even counterinsurgency. Colonial armies in particular were their school. Koreans gained valuable technical and managerial experience in government, army, the Kwaiosaki, the fascist party aspiring to Bomazan. Koreans gained valuable technical and managerial experience in government, army, the Kwaiowakai, K-Y-O-W-A-K-I, the fascist party aspiring to link government and people, and police, as well as in the hospitals and factories of Manchukuo. This differs greatly from the experience of most of the Koreans who migrated to or studied in Japan during the colonial period, the majority of whom were confined to jobs as manual workers there. Manchukuo was a land of opportunity not only for Japanese, but also for Koreans. These, quote, Manchurians, unquote, possessed comparative advantages in the quest for power and position in post-liberation Korea, where a power vacuum emerged following the departure of Japanese rulers. The next section is called U.S. Hegemony. The necessary condition for the employment of their talent was U.S. hegemony, which was established in South Korea after liberation. South Korea was very different from North Korea, where landlords and pro-Japanese collaborators were eradicated or fled to the South. Nationalists, particularly those who emerged from the anti-Japanese resistance, were not welcomed into the South Korean administration, army, or police force built by the occupying U.S. forces. A special committee set up under the new Korean Congress in 1948 to investigate the activities of those who had worked for the Japanese Empire was suppressed by the U.S.-backed Syngman Rhee government, particularly by the Korean police, whose higher echelons were largely staffed with ex-colonial police from the Japanese occupation. It, that is to say, the special committee, was disbanded within half a year. Koreans who had been trained by and served in Japanese forces in Manchuria were favored in the Korean army. Former officers of the Manchukuo army obtained recognition for suppressing the revolutionary guerrillas in, quote, bandit, unquote, suppression campaigns in Manchukuo. Later, they became the main pillar of Park's regime, which confronted the North Korean state that was built on the foundations of the anti-Japanese guerrilla movement on the Manchukuo-Korean border. The, quote, Manchurians, unquote, led several realms in Park's modernization project, including the formulation of the military nationalist Hwarang ideologist, capital H-W-A-R-A-N-G. Even in the music world, they led the way, organizing the Korean Navy Orchestra and Army Orchestra, producing numerous songs that served the regime during important moments of state building, as well as in the dispatch of Korean forces to participate in the Vietnam War. Interestingly, those who had been high officials of the colonial state in South Korea were overshadowed in the 1960s, their positions largely secured by the, quote, Manchurians, unquote, who spearheaded the competition with the Northern regime throughout the Cold War era. With often only the slightest change of ideas, plans, institutes, even the very words employed in Manchukuo were subsequently revived by them in South Korea. The focus was on transforming South Korea into an industrial warrior nation capable not only of competing with North Korea, but also ultimately of climbing the ladder of the capitalist world system. The rise of, quote, Manchurians, unquote, was facilitated by the Korean-Japanese normalization of 1965, masterminded by the U.S., which was a kind of reunion of Manchurians on both sides. Ex-Japanese Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi and his right-hand man, Etsuburo Shina, E-T-S-A-B-U-R-O, S-H-I-A-S-H-I-I-N-A, who had run the control economy of Manchukuo, were behind the normalization. This last sentence again. Ex-Japanese Prime Minister Nobusuke Kishi and his right-hand man, Etsuburo Shina, who had run the control economy of Manchukuo, were behind the normalization. And in our next program, we will continue with our examination of not only the Japanese influence in South Korea, but the things that led up to the chilling attempt at declaring martial law and perhaps igniting war with North Korea, something with Donald Trump now occupying the White House, something that I think should be of concern to all of us. The new 64-gigabyte flash drive is not ready yet. It will be ready. It will include all of these programs about Korea. So please be aware of that. I get no money whatsoever from that. It is not ready yet. It will be ready presently and later in the year. And there's also a mini library of old anti-fascist books on easy-to-download PDF files. And again, I get no money whatsoever from that flash drive. This concludes For the Record program number 1369, Korea on Our Minds, Part 2. This is being recorded on January 25th of the year 2025. I'm Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.